You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone, or good day, wherever you may be on this planet or in this country. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. And I have the distinct honor and privilege of welcoming General Joseph Lengyel to join with us today in conversation. He is the chief of the National Guard Bureau, which means he is a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the nation's top officer for overseeing the Army and the Air Force National Guard. Combined, a total strength of nearly 500,000 airmen and soldiers under his supervision and command. And he is a distinguished airman himself, a fighter pilot, a Texan, formerly of the active duty Air Force, but then in the early 1990s switched to National Guard and did a number of stints in various positions in the United States and around the world, sometimes in more of a guard capacity or part-time capacity, sometimes full-time, and for the last 8 years has been at the leadership of the National Guard Bureau here in Washington, first as its vice chief and now as its top officer. We're really privileged to have him today as he prepares for fairly imminent retirement, very richly deserved and well-earned, dating back to his ROTC degree and entry into the Air Force. The graduation from that ROTC program at the University of North Texas was 1981. So he's been serving his country long and very well. Despite his youthful appearance, he's been in and at it for quite a while, and we wish him well, certainly, in retirement. But before we do that, we look forward to a rich conversation today, at the end of which we'll be able to handle some of your questions if you wish to email to events@brookings.edu. I will ultimately transmit some of those questions to the general. But first, we're going to hear from him with some opening thoughts on the state of the Guard and also, of course, on its help and its admirable and much appreciated help in responding to the COVID crisis in the United States. But that will not be our only topic. This will also be an opportunity to think a little bit more broadly about the Guard and its role in the nation's total force at this very difficult moment in our history with the return of great power competition and other challenges around the globe. So, General, thank you again for joining us. And without further ado, over to you, my friend.
So, Michael, thank you. Thank you to Brookings for having me on today to talk about the National Guard. It's, you know, I've been in it for a very long time. I've learned a lot. I have experienced a complete transformation of what the National Guard brings in terms of combat capability. From a readiness model, from an operation, from a strategic reserve to an operational force, to the roles we play across all of society every day. You go back to the beginning of the year, January 2020. I don't know that we could have predicted what would happen in the next 6 months. As you all recall, remember early in January, the topic was potential kinetic operations with Iran post attack on Soleimani. Everybody remembers that tensions were running high. We were considered. Were we going to ramp up and need National Guard mobilizations in support of further operations in CENTCOM. 2 months later, we had the California National Guard drop coronavirus test kits onto a cruise ship that was anchored off the coast of San Francisco. And that was even before the coronavirus became a national pandemic and a national emergency. And 2 months later, yet again, Mr. George Floyd was killed. And that sparked widespread nationwide unrest, the likes of which we have not seen. In the midst of all these headline-grabbing events, the National Guard has also responded to national disasters, as you know we're prone to do, whether it's floods in Michigan, wildfires in Kansas, tornadoes in Tennessee, just to name a few. And it has been a crazy year, and it's just now early July. And I think in the past 6 months, if you look at the totality of the effort from the National Guard, including our federal missions, more than 120,000 members of the National Guard were mobilized wearing a uniform, doing either operations for a combatant commander, 45,000 more doing COVID operations in every state, territory, in the District of Columbia. And again, 45,000 more were doing operations in support of civil disturbance operations in 33 states. All across the country, the National Guard was aiding American people. They were delivering personal protective equipment. In some cases, they were manufacturing personal protective equipment staffing food banks and test centers, protecting protesters' First Amendment rights to protest peacefully, sharing best practices as we learned, frankly, how to do some of these things. And in this difficult time, but it's also a time of great flexibility and great innovation and showcasing the capabilities of the National Guard. We're doing all these while we sustained our federal commitments to combatant commands around the world as part of the Army and the Air Force. None of our Title 10 or federal missions were interrupted or disturbed. Thankfully, the civil disturbance operations seem to be receding. But COVID-19 appears to be maybe even on the rise in some cases, and there's no sign of operational tempo reduction in our future as we look to the relatively near term 6 months or a year. And if the events of the past 6 months have taught us anything, it's that the role of the reserve component, and in my case, I'll speak to the National Guard, as you mentioned, which is about 20%, more than 20% of all of the uniforms in the Department of Defense, the National Guard has proven an indispensable force that America needs. So my thoughts on some things that I would like to share with the group is we've learned a lot about what this operational force is and how to use it. And I'm going to make four main points. One is that we have become an operational force with continuous and sustained rotations, a part of the Army and the Air Force, and that's a good thing. And from the full spectrum operations to full land component, air component, full spectrum war, and everything in between, we have become an indispensable part of the toolkit of the Army and the Air Force to do their Title 10 and federal missions, and that needs to continue. That has led to some other things, but I'll get to those in a bit, maybe in some questions. The second thing is, I think that what we have learned is, you know, that the strength of our force is experience. Its cost structure when we are not being used is less than active component structure. So the ability to posture reserve component force structure in the future against known requirements, I think is something that we should continue to do and we should continue to leverage. Known deployments for the National Guard are a good thing. It builds readiness for us. And when you do that, it allows us to be predictable for our business model, which must fit into people who have other careers and other employers so that we can let them know and train to the appropriate level of readiness as we do that. So that's number two, is leverage us more against known requirements. And in some cases we do that today, but I think there's opportunity to do more of that. The third thing is, in the old model, strategic reserve model, we could take new equipment, put it in the active component, shake out all the old, all of the older stuff and cascade that into the reserve components, and that model does not work. You must be deployable, sustainable, and interoperable, or you're irrelevant in any battle scenario. And so the concurrent and balanced recapitalization and modernization of our force is something that I worked hard to stump for as we move forward with this operational reserve model. And finally, the last thing that I say is, we're, you know, in historic times here as we stand up another service, another branch of service of the Space Force. And I do believe that there is advantages to taking the model of the National Guard and leveraging that and creating a Space National Guard component of the Space Force. We've been in the space mission for 25 years, and I want to make sure that one of the most important things we do is we are mirrors of our parent service. The culture, the training, the professional development of our Army officers are identical in the Air National Guard and the Army National Guard as our parent services. And that has got to remain the same as part of the Space Force. So adopting these considerations could actually free up active component force structure such that we make it ready. And it is our most flexible piece of the force. It can go anywhere. It can be anywhere. It can do things that we simply aren't built to do in the reserve component. And so by doing that, by using known deployments to put requirements against the reserve components, if they're available with force elements and training, I think that frees up, maybe a more efficient active component to be used. So the operational model we talk about, I would share that, you know, always ready, always there is kind of our motto. And people seem to think of us as, you know, a slower version of the Army and a slower version of the Air Force. I think that in the Air Force, we've proven time and again, we train to the same levels of readiness as our active components. And while we're not as fast, we're pretty darn close to as fast as an Air Force squadron if you want to move it someplace. I would say that on the Army side, it is slower. We have less readiness built intentionally. We don't build readiness until we're going to use it. And I think that's a good thing because readiness is expensive to build. And as you build it, that's why you don't buy tomatoes in bushels, because you can't eat them fast enough and they will rot. So you want to build it just in time. Using us as a force that allows us to determine assigned mission readiness, I think is something that we should leverage more frequently. Now, you may not want to send the 82nd Airborne to deal with some issue in Ebola in Africa when you could train up some reserve component squadron to a lesser rotational requirement and do that. So I think that's important. And as I mentioned, the operational force, we provide strategic depth to the Army and to the Air Force, and someday to the Space Force. I believe that will happen eventually. But proven combat capability at a lower cost is a good investment. And it allows us to sustain combat capability in capacity terms for the potential of a major war, and allows us to save money on an active component. Active component is responsive, it's fast, it's ready, but it's expensive. And to allow us to save money to modernize that force and have the new and needed weapons that we need in the future. So I think that, using us for readiness capabilities in the future, as you look at potential rotational models in Europe or potential rotational models in Korea, it's a good thing when you consider, using the reserve components to do that. Modernization, again, want to hit one more time that I think the ability to modernize the force is important. And I think, I've been in, the second base to get the KC-46 was Pease, New Hampshire National Guard unit. Vermont was the second unit in the Air Force to get the F-35, and they've announced more of those. So the Air Force has seized that and recognizes that. And I believe that on the Army side, the same thing will be true, whether it's new helicopters, vertical lift, or other capabilities that the Army has. Because what we have learned over time is when the active component no longer has a piece of equipment, it begins to die. It begins to become less sustained. They don't intend to cut back on the money. They don't intend to not sustain it. They don't intend on not to maintain it. But they will make hard financial decisions over time that will force them to not sustain that equipment. And when you can't, then it becomes indeployable, non-deployable, not sustainable in a combat environment, and becomes a burden on the system. The Space National Guard is, if I've been too subtle in my support of that component here, I want to make sure that, that we've been in the space mission as part of the Air Force for 25 years. And one of the things that the National Guard brings is it brings unit-equipped force structure to our parent services. If you need to grow the capacity of the Army or the capacity of the Air Force or the capacity of a Space Force in time of war, you can't do that with individual augmentees and single people. You have to have unit structure that can be mobilized and increase the size and the capacity of the force. And that is what we bring. We bring the obvious attributes that have been on display for the last 6 months. While we are in dwell from our Title 10 responsibilities, we can also be tasked by our governors to do any number of things. And as you have seen, we've had infantry officers running food banks, and that certainly was not anything that they were trained to. We've had them running test sites for people to get COVID. They can be task organized with leadership at every level, and they can do any tasks that our nation needs them to do. And we've done a myriad of different tasks throughout the COVID operations here that we can get into more if you want. So I think in conclusion, I think the past 6 months have shown, and if you really want to get into it, I think if you go back to 9/11, the sustained continuous deployment, more than 1 million members of the National Guard have been deployed into the combat zone in every combatant command, many of them multiple times. Our formations have gone, since I have been chief, we have sustained about continuously 30,000 men and women of the National Guard deployed at any one time doing Title 10 things. And continuously on top of that, about another 10,000 have been deployed doing things here in the homeland, Southwest border operations, continuous things that you've seen up in New York. If you've been in the Grand Central and you see Empire Shield folks sitting in there, keeping counterterrorism opportunities from happening. Our ability to do things in the homeland have been enormous. And on display lately has been the COVID operations, which as I'm talking to you now, we still have some 32,000 men and women doing that. And thankfully, the civilian disturbance operations are beginning to recede, although we are postured right now as we speak to respond in support of our governors and in support of law enforcement should events turn sideways and our system need it. So, you know, with that, I think the Guard has proven that we're always ready, always there. And I'm very proud of this. I think we were called in a recent article, the Swiss Army knife of the United States military. But we can be tasked to do a myriad of things from pandemics to full spectrum war. And it's been the joy of my life to be the chief of the National Guard Bureau here at the end of it. So with that, I'll just pause and stop my remarks and say thanks and turn it over to you, Michael, for some questions.
General, fantastic. Thank you for that framing. And I want to ask a couple of different questions about the Guard going forward. But to set that up, I want to build on and ask you to build on some of what you touched on, sort of looking back on the Guard and the ways we thought about it and how it's evolved over your career, partly because you are soon to retire and you've seen so much. But also, I think it helps dramatize the choices for the nation going forward. I think we all know we're getting into potentially a difficult fiscal environment, to say the least, after COVID. And this is not a particularly partisan issue. People on both sides of the aisle understand that there may be severe pressure on the defense budget in the years ahead, you know, even if it doesn't transpire in the next 4 months of the political campaigns this year. And by the way, I should have noted Brookings has people who work on various campaigns, and that's all on our website. But this is not a partisan question. This is an awareness that the country may be looking for ways to build a more economical military in the years ahead. So I want to ask you in a minute about ways in which the Guard could contribute to that, perhaps becoming a larger overall fraction of the nation's armed forces. But I think to set that up, we should spend a little more time on the history that you've lived, because we know that coming out of Vietnam, before you and I were old enough to be in the military ourselves, but there was the concept of the total force, which basically was a decision that the Guard and Reserve should be integral to any kind of major American military deployment. So we would never again have this division between an active force that was sort of not known, not understood, not integrated with communities back home and the rest of society. So we have that concept of a total force with the Reserve, maybe more than the Guard, but both the Reserve and the Guard playing a role at providing capabilities the active force simply doesn't have, so that it would need to be mobilized going into a major conflict. That's one concept. Then you alluded to a second concept, which is sort of the old idea of a strategic reserve, the Guard sort of being the backup, especially in the Cold War, if we had a long protracted fight with the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact. And, you know, in those days, again, as you alluded to, the Guard had old equipment. It wasn't necessarily anywhere near as good as the active force. It wasn't really thought of as the initial part of the response or even the second wave. It was more like your third or fourth wave if you fought a multi-year conflict. And then we saw, as you say, especially after 9/11, I think, the Guard become actually an operational part of the military, that you used Guard units because they had nearly the same capabilities or as good capabilities as the active force, and they could help give a break to the active force. They could spell it. They could do things sometimes more economically. So that's the overall lay of the land. With that in mind, I wanted to ask you if you wanted to comment any further, but also specifically, how good has the Guard become in being almost as capable or as capable as the active force? You mentioned Desert Storm as the time, sort of the transition in your career going from the active to the National Guard. There's still a debate, especially in the Army, about just how well the National Guard brigades could have performed in Desert Storm. The Army had a big internal fight about whether they should have used the National Guard more in that conflict. There are still debates about whether National Guard brigades in Iraq and Afghanistan performed as well in the tougher sectors. What do we know, especially about the Army side, where, as you say, it's harder to maintain unit readiness. These are big formations. What do we know about the ability of a National Guard Army brigade to be just as good as an active Army brigade? And again, looking at it with this historical perspective, I'm sorry for the long question, but I wanted to sort of frame this and pick up on your points about how the Guard has evolved over your career, ask you to reflect a little more on that, and then speak to how good the Guard has become today. Over to you, please.
So we are a completely different force than the one I joined, you know, almost 30 years ago. We're more ready. We're more disciplined. We have become, and again, my experience predominantly until the last eight years or so has been predominantly Air Force, but we have become exactly what the Air Force demanded that we become. Part of that was, you know, a great reduction in the size of the Air Force, coupled with continuous deployment cycles to the Middle East since the early 90s and the mid 90s following the Gulf War. They needed the National Guard to become part of the deployable cadre, if you will, that could go. And when we deployed, we had to deploy with our own kit, with our own commanders. It had to work. So the Air Force really, you know, and it could that, you know, I like to think that coupled with 1991, that changed the Air Force, the getting smaller of it, many of the active component folks, of which I was one, migrated into the Air National Guard. And we brought with us this sense of sort of a more disciplined Air Force, if you will, I think, a more tactically oriented Air Force, more connected to the active components maybe than we were before when we had separate components. And I like to think that sometimes I think that it was just the National Guard got better. But as I look, I live out here on Fort McNair, and there used to be a golf course on this particular base. There's no golf course anymore. There's no time for golf courses at National Defense University. People are focused on strategy and developing officers and professional officers, and there's less time for those kinds of things. But I can just tell you, when I left Ramstein, I had out of the active component to join the Texas Guard. I said, I'm going to make the best fighter squadron in the world. I was a weapons officer. Who would not have that goal? And I got to my place, and I said, hey, there's a bunch of really great fighter pilots here, but I had six full-time people in the unit. The rest were all part-time. The maintainers were very experienced, but you know, they had been stationed there in San Antonio for a very long time. And I said, hey, we're not gonna do this. I had doctors and bankers and farmers people that came and flew fighters part-time, and flying fighters part-time is, I mean, it's full-time work to get to a point where you can employ those weapon systems to the degree that the Air Force needs them. So we now have that. There's many more full-time people in the Air National Guard than there used to be. It is a better equipped, newer equipped, has more equipment in it that's better. And it's just a better, more disciplined, more combat capable force than the one I joined. I would say the Army side of this thing, and again, I talk with somewhat less credibility, but I will tell you, to train an Army Brigade combat team, It is a monster undertaking of logistics, of training, of operations collectively to maneuver through 3,500 people into NTC and get it all integrated together to work and to practice it. You know, the Air Force is a platform-based system. You get the F-16, you get six of them, you can go fly anywhere, do your wartime mission from your home base. The Army, not so much. You can do little pieces of it. But to do the collective training required for the big Army formations, it's hard to do, and it's expensive, and it takes time. And you know, time is one of the biggest limitations we have as members of the Guard and Reserve. And I watch some of these folks in the brigades here that go to national training centers, and as they work up to go to a national training center rotation, the commanders, the company commanders, the battalion commanders, they will have entire lives as accountants or salesmen or doctors or whatever they do in their civilian lives. But then they will have to dedicate 90 or 100 days to get to that culminating readiness event to make that brigade combat team ready to go to war or to go on a deployment. And it's just, it's hard. It is hard work. I've watched it. I've gone out there. There's no similar mechanism in the air side to watch how a brigade combat team trains. That said, all the same things apply, though. The Army demanded same standards, same fitness, same rigorous application of training resources towards, you know, individual training statuses and collective training statuses. And we're a better, more disciplined force. And we may not be able to get out the door as fast as you know, an active duty Army brigade can. Maybe we take 90 days or 100 days, which sounds like a long time. But when you talk about the movement to a war zone of equipment and brigades that have to ship, that whole process takes a long time. And one of the things that I like most about this rotational operational force that we've become on both the Army and the air side is mobilization of the force. It is a national strategic capability that we need to exercise and use. If you can't pick up your force and move it someplace, train it and move it, and if you don't practice those kinds of things, when you need to do it to go fight a China or go fight a Russia, it will be impossible to do. So those things need to be practiced, and that's yet another reason to continue to do it. But you are right. I mean, you know, as we watched, late last year, we saw the some of the folks who were pulling forces out of Syria, moving into the eastern part of Syria. And the National Guard, the North Carolina National Guard, had just got into Kuwait, and they were the first ones up into Syria with the 30th Brigade Combat Team. And there was comments all over the place about the world has flipped upside down. We have the National Guard in Syria, and we have the active army on the southwest border. And what really came to defend that was all the other comments from, hey, the Guard is ready, they're trained, they're a different force than people think of them back in the Vietnam and pre-era of our existence. And they're ready to do it, and they are, and they're still there, and they're still doing a great job. So we are without a doubt a different force altogether. We still have some limitations on I think when I've read the reports too of deployed capability in the war zone, and most of the ones I've read, said that the National Guard formations performed great. They did a great job. There was no difference really between what they were doing. And others will tell you, well, that's an apples, not an apples to apples comparison. They had a different role, different mission, different area. But still, I think, we have proven ourselves as viable combat capability that can, and I believe this to be true, enable investment in the national defense strategy such that you can use us as credible combat forces, such that you can invest money in buying new things, which is very expensive to do, as we've seen. So I hope that answers your question.
That's very helpful. I wanted to follow up on the money and resources question. Sort of, I have two main questions or curiosities here. One is just if you have a simple rule of thumb in your own mind for how much a National Guard formation costs relative to an active formation. Obviously, it's going to vary depending on the equipment. But I think what you've basically told us today is that, and this is a good thing, there's no longer any real savings in the money you spend to equip a Guard formation because it's designed to be just as good. And therefore, it has to have just as good stuff, and it has to be interoperable with the active force. So out of that roughly one third of the Pentagon budget that is devoted to acquisition and weaponry, there's basically very little savings whether you're National Guard or Reserve, but it's the two thirds of the money that goes to people where you can leverage savings of anywhere from, certainly more than half, probably as much as two thirds to three fourths of the people side and the operating and maintenance side. So I'm guessing that a Guard unit should be thought of as roughly half as expensive. When you put all this stuff together into the same picture and you average across different kinds of units, a National Guard unit should be probably about half as expensive when it's not being deployed as an active unit. Is that sort of a rough figure that you use as well?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I'm always trying to be careful and fair when I start talking about numbers, but it is the people that cost less. And, the Air National Guard is, it's about 100,000, 110,000 people. And we have 35,000 of them are full time. So obviously, the savings comes from all of the part time folks, which cost about a third of what it costs to have a full time employee. On the Army side of that coin, 340,000 actively in there. And of that, about 16% of that force is full time, very small percentage of the time. So that's where we save the money. And I can show you numbers where it says, hey, a brigade in the Guard, an Army infantry brigade that is not deployed, we're just doing our yearly training cycle, costs about a third of an infantry brigade that is full-time and it's not deployed, but everybody there is full-time. So the savings isn't people, it is in money. And, that is where I think long-term, as much as I think a 3% pay raise would be great for the folks next year, that is a lot of money that the Department of Defense cannot spend on other things like buying new technology and new equipment.
Excellent. I wanted to also ask about the internal decision making about resourcing the Guard, because it's now been, well, how long, 8 or 10 years that a guard officer has been part of the Joint Chiefs?
That's right. It's 9 years ago. Yeah, it happened. So it's 9 years.
So has that helped? Has that, or do you think that the Air Force, and I'm not trying to revisit this issue or this question, but what, based on your experience as the vice chief and now the chief of the National Guard Bureau, is having a seat at that table important for making sure that the Guard is resourced correctly? Or do you also think that the services themselves have started to get it and get religion on this question, and they themselves have figured out that, you know, while your voice is still helpful, they also are major proponents of properly sourcing and resourcing the National Guard?
So I think number two is the truth. I think that, both chiefs of the Army and Air Force that I work with, General Goldfein, who I've known for a long time, and then General Milley and then General McConville, have all seen the reserve components and in particular the National Guard, an integral part of their force. They want to keep it ready and operational because they use it. Again, back to the operational force, is when they use you, when they deploy you, they see value in investing in you. And they then free up money that gives you training. They then free up money that buys you new equipment and gives you dollars to keep it ready because they see operational utility from your force. And that's just fundamentally changed in the Department of Defense, particularly since 9/11. And, I told you that story about showing up to Texas, you know, and I said, I'm going to make this the best fighter squadron in the world. I would say we could have gone to war and supported the effort, and we could have, credibly done what the Air Force asked us to, but you might not have wanted us to be out front and the lead unit in a package to downtown Baghdad or anywhere else. But I would tell you that today, if you had a National Guard unit over there doing something like that, General Goldfein, I say with some certainty, would be comfortable with any role that unit were to be a player. They could be the quarterback of the biggest package going anywhere, anytime, in any platform. And that's because they've invested in us, they have used us, and they really have stepped up to the plate.
I think you've begun to explain and answer my next question, but let me put it before you as well. Sort of the state of people inside the National Guard. Obviously, you've been talking and extolling their virtues and their accomplishments. They're obviously very good. And you've also been saying that they're doing a lot. You like that. And maybe they could even do more. But I know, of course, they also have lives back home. For the 70% of the Air National Guard and the 90% of the Army National Guard that's not working full time for those organizations. And so there's got to be some limit on just how hard you can push them. And also there probably are some limits on your ability to recruit and retain. So in terms of op tempo and recruiting and retention, how you doing? Do you see any particular problems, any particular concerns?
So I think we're doing well. Before the coronavirus and before the economic turndown and the economy where it began to contract, I think I would have said that, it's getting a little more difficult for us to retain some of our airline pilots who used to say, I'm going to go into the Air Guard and do that. And while I'm an airline pilot, a lot of folks were choosing not to do that. So we're starting to see a little bit harder time to keep our forces in the aviation business. That 90 to 100 days that I told you for the brigade commander, the problem with our forces, high speed National Guardsmen happen to be high speed civilians too. It translates. So as we go up to the top of the pair and you get to the command level, somebody that's at that 15, 18, 20 year point, and you want them to stay to be division commanders or, longer, bigger, they're having to make a choice now with, hey, I've been fabulously successful in both careers. And now they want me to be a vice president and I can't do all of this at once. So we are seeing that competition continues to happen because we promote the best people to do our hardest jobs. And those people are usually, lighting it up in their civilian careers. So, I think that will continue to be a challenge. The way we manage talent, the way we recruit talent, the way we treat that talent when it's with us. And I think it's hugely important, the discussion that we're having now with with diversity in our force and treating people and giving everybody equal opportunities to command and lead and be there. We have got to do better on that. Find opportunities such that across our force, I sense right now we're kind of in a little different spot. We are going to make some fundamental shifts and changes that allow us to grow and get the best talent, that all of them don't look like me as white men, you know, I think is something that I think is a good thing. And so recruiting is always difficult. When you look at what the military does, all the services every year, there's a population of about 350,000 people that we all try to get. They're all the same age. They're all morally and fit. They're fit, and they're high school graduates. So we all compete for that. And I have to get 45 of them in the Army National Guard and 10 to 15,000 of them in the Air National Guard. And the Army tries to get 70,000 and the Air Force tries to get 50. You start going through that competition for talent pretty quick. So, that's the key is we will offer somebody, I tell the story about I was at Ohio Food Bank being run by a lieutenant who was an infantry officer who in his civilian life was an accountant for Deloitte. And so here he is doing an accountant job that's an infantry officer that is that day charged with running a food bank. So you get those people, and this guy was high speed. I'm telling you, he was super high speed. So the ability to find and keep those people has never been more important than it is now. And we continue to ask them and their families and their employers. We have to incentivize, the ability of employers to let their people go. And I'll use mine. I've been an employee for a major airline, and I've been on military leave for 17 consecutive years, 17 years. They're proud of me. I'm the only 4-star airline pilot in the business. And they talk about me, but to treat them right and make sure that it's in their interest to support the military members who want to serve it's very important to us.
So that leads me to my last question, and then we've got a number already that have come in from the audience, which I'll get to next. But I wanted to ask you about the future. And I know this is a little bit, I'm not asking you to advocate for a certain policy, because I think we're too early to do that in what any new presidential term, whether it's reelected President Trump or President Biden, or whatever kind of new defense team is assembled by either one, and whatever the fiscal and other priorities of the country are as we come out of COVID next year, God willing. And there is the possibility of a defense debate, at least where people are asking fundamental questions. Is there a way to maintain more or less the national defense strategy to cope with a rising China and Russia, as well as, the ongoing concerns in North Korea and Iran and the broader Middle East with terrorism? Is there a way to do that less expensively, in the context of a broader government effort to reduce the deficit and put a cap on the debt? I think that question is going to be raised next year. And again, without asking you to advocate for a specific answer, I guess the simple question I have on my mind, as we brainstorm about the future active reserve mix in the US military, let's just imagine we keep the size of the overall total force roughly constant at around 2.1 million total personnel, about 1.3 million active duty, about 800,000 in the reserve component, of which 450,000 are yours, 350,000 of which are for the services, just to review the basic facts and figures. And if we imagine the kinds of changes we might make, is it plausible that the reserve component could be half as big as the could be half of the total force, could be as much as, let's say, a million or even a little over out of that total force of 2.1 million, as we just brainstorm, just options that we should be considering, not ones we're going to advocate or implement. Could we even go as high as to make half of our military the reserve component, either guard or reserve?
Yeah, Michael, I'll tell you, I would say that, it always depends, right? I mean, I think the National Guard and the reserves have proven themselves a credible combat force, properly trained, properly equipped. We could go anywhere and we can do the missions the nation's asked us to do. We've proven it. We're doing it right now. Could the National Guard be bigger? I would say it could. It's all a risk equation. On the air side, I see very little risk in larger structure in the National Guard. But what the Pentagon sees, and I look through their lens, is Are we fast enough? Are we responsive enough? They talk about access to the reserve component. That's a concept that I have to talk about routinely inside the Pentagon. You know, the way that you can get the reserve component to go be part of your force is we have to be mobilized. And those mobilization authorizations are in law and they come from Congress. And so is there friction sometimes or perceived risk in that I won't be able to get access to them fast enough or soon enough? And I think that's a fair concern. And I think that I would say that that friction, though, I think is intentionally built into the system. You know, Congress never intended for the DoD to be able to skidgy across the Pacific and go to war without mobilizing the reserve component. It's some of the levers that we have that keep civilian control over what our military does, and America kind of gets a vote. I think that using the reserve component, we're in many states and counties where the only uniforms they ever see are men and women of the National Guard. The folks that pack up and deploy to war, to Afghanistan, they go do assurance missions in Europe, prepare and go to do whatever the nation needs to do. It keeps America connected to what they're doing now. So we are absolutely a tool that the Department of Defense said, in the event we would go to war with a China or a Russia, we need the force to be this big, you can keep capacity in the reserve component at a lower cost. And then you have to ask the rest of the subject, the questions of, well, what else are you going to do? I mean, if you're going to have military force structure forward postured in Africa and Europe and Asia and the rest, you know, we can help there on a rotational basis. We can't go live there. That's not the way that works for us. So without a doubt, I think that when they go to look at decisions and how we only have so much money to spend, if you decide you need X number of brigades, combat teams, you should look closely and go, can this force be in the reserve component? And if the answer to that question is, we think that, you know, timelines being what they are, we can only move X number of brigades this fast anyway, and by the time you get to these other brigades, we can have the National Guard forces trained and ready. Then if you're in that business of trying to find resources to buy new things, whether they be space or nukes or hypersonic weapons or whatever they may be, you may choose to take risk in that portfolio of, I've got a slightly less responsive force that I'll have to train up and deploy, but I now have money to buy new weapons and technology for it. So it's a risk balancing equation that the Department of Defense wrestles with every day. But we clearly, in my view, in my personal view, there are places that we could be bigger and mitigate that risk and save money. I certainly wouldn't advocate shrinking the reserve component and buying a bigger active component, only because I've just watched what we do. And I think we are supremely experts at helping the Army and the Air Force do what they need.
By the way, let me just say something that, of course, is obvious to you, but just for any part of the audience that may not be as familiar with these terms or organizations. So there are six different organizations that are part of the reserve component of the U.S. military, because each service has its reserve. And then General Lengel is in charge of the National Guard for the Army and the Air Force. So there are a total of six. And those six encompass 800,000 uniformed personnel. My question is, if we have a total force of 2.1 million, right now we have 800,000 reserve component, of which 450,000 or so are National Guard, 350,000 are reserve. Out of that 800,000, could that number grow even up to a million? And so we had basically close to half of the military in the reserve component, close to half in the active force. I'll be intrigued to see if that kind of question gets asked next year. But now we have some questions, General, from the audience, and one's starting from very specific but important vantage point about COVID-19, wondering if social distancing and also absentee and attrition from the disease have had bad effects on your maintenance, on your ability to keep aviation units in good shape, or are you able so far to maintain readiness despite the restrictions from the COVID-19 partial shutdown, if you will?
No, great question. So we've not had a large reduction in our readiness as a result of COVID-19. And strangely enough, I would offer that You know, we made some changes to how we did business to prevent, you know, a full up infection of any given unit. We started breaking, they say, maintainers into smaller groups that some would come in and work in the day, some would come in at night, minimize the interaction between the groups and such that you wouldn't get everybody sick if you did. And strangely enough, in some cases, we found that we're more efficient and are getting more maintenance done because we have started doing business slightly differently. We've had, you know, I think just under 2,000 total cases in the National Guard of COVID-19 infections. One death, thankfully, only one a soldier in the New Jersey National Guard died early on in this. But overall, I think we've made all the same changes that the active components has. It's, you know, all the impacts it's had to accessions it had on us, all the impacts to some of our collective training events. And we didn't have drill weekends for a couple of months, but we found ways to do things on telework and distancing and the like that have helped. I think broadly speaking, COVID has changed some of the things inside the department and inside of our operations. We always said we could telework, but until we actually really had to do it, we found we didn't have enough bandwidth. The software wasn't good enough. We couldn't do things like we're doing right now simply and easily without technical difficulties. We can now. And I suspect going forward, we're going to save money on conferences and things before that we have just learned how to do it differently. And so COVID's had an impact. We do very closely. We follow all the CDC guidelines. It's had impacts on moving people, impacts on deployments in and out, impacts on going into host nations who want us to quarantine. And we're doing all of those things. But like many of you, I'm ready for that vaccine to come from Project Warp Speed here pretty soon. Let's get that thing going, made and out there. I don't know that I want to do what the Chinese have done and use their military as a test bed for it, but I think we should we should get that out there and get it done as quick as we can.
Thank you. You have a question from one of your incoming congressional fellows to Capitol Hill from the National Guard, who wonders if there is a specific set of priorities for the upcoming, you know, or ongoing budget season, but especially next year. Now, obviously, as you and I were just discussing, there's going to be a potential big budget debate next year. But beyond that, he wondered if there were specific priorities on your mind.
So, you know, in the, you know, our considerations have always been readiness, has been how do we make us be able to get ready faster? And that's been my entire tenure, build a more lethal force and do that stuff. We believe that we have asked for, you know, some additional full-time support. And I'm very cautious when I do that because it's money. It changes our business model every time we talk about it, you know, and I tell the force that, you know, basically we look at our business model and it comes down to, are we of value to the Department of Defense? And I make the assessment that the value is determined by, hey, how good are you? And then how big are you? And how easy is it to use you? And you divide that by the cost. And there's a number that comes out of that. How good are we? That's our training. That's the way we practice, we train, and we make ourselves ready. How big we are, Congress gets to decide that. And how easy can they access us? That's sort of our streamlined process of using the mobilization authorities that we have. Divide that by the cost. The biggest number in that cost that changes is people. And so every time we ask, it says, I need more people, more full-time people to do this. I have to think very, very hard and tell commanders, hey, go look at that and say, is that really what you do? Because you change that value equation every time we do that. So readiness, people, training, making sure that they're the right things that has been out there. And innovation, not necessarily a legislative priority for us, but it's been a priority for us to look at new things like 3D printing and 3D manufacturing of the ways we do business. Can we take that stuff and deploy with it, operate in new and different ways, leverage these IT things that we've learned through by going through this COVID operation here, have all been amazingly important. So those are the kinds of things that we're looking for on the Hill as we do that. I've tried to get, I wanted a Space Force in this thing and I wasn't successful, I don't think, in making that happen. There's still a lot of concern, some reason on the creation of a Space National Guard component. We'll keep doing that. Eventually, the Hill will decide what they want that to look like. General Raymond, Air Force, Secretary Barrett will decide what that looks like. And maintaining our forces and our facilities, those are all standard LL priorities that we always have. Thanks for that question.
There's another question about how do you balance the need for protecting the civilian, you know, jobs and lives of your guardsmen with the desire to be operationally relevant and involved? And maybe one way to phrase it, I remember a few years ago, the basic rule of thumb that the military was trying to establish after the surges in Iraq and Afghanistan, trying to get back to an active duty force where there would be a dwell time of, you know, 2 years at home for every 1 year deployed at a minimum. And for the guard, it was more like 5-1, guard and reserve, as I recall. Is that maybe one of the ways you try to establish this balance? Is there sort of a rule of thumb that you try to avoid over-deploying people and use that rule of thumb as a quantitative metric?
Yeah, no, those are the standard numbers that we use for 12 to deploy rates, and we still use those. I think that our job as becoming this operational force has been to kind of push the limits of those. I mean, I have wanted to, if we don't feel any pain in the system, then we're not probably training enough and we're not being used enough. Feeling some pain is a good thing in my view. If we were, you know, never being used and employers were never having to deal with us being gone, then I would say then you'd have to question the investment in the National Guard and why are you doing it if you're never using it? You're building this force. And those deployments, again, make us a better, more usable force. The whole idea being occasional, routine, regular deployments of our force make us be able to integrate, plug in, save, stay modernized such that when you need it, you know, if you go to the full mobilization scenario that we haven't used since World War II, and everybody is now in the Army till the end of the war plus 6 months, now you have a force that can integrate and can be used. If you never use it, then I think that's kind of a fallacy, that full mobilization thing. It's so hard to do that it just sucks up too much of your resources to make it work. So I think civilian jobs in some of our higher demands, we have to be careful. You know, a lot of police officers came on duty for us when the civil unrest happened. That drains police officers from the civilian force where they serve and live. You know, when you deploy a unit of MPs from someplace in Vermont, you take a lot of the police officers out of that town in Vermont. We deploy from towns and they go. So they have to watch that and we have to watch that. And that's why predictability is so key for us. If we have known deployments, whether they be to the Sinai for, you know, the multinational force and observer mission, or whether they're into Kosovo or even Kuwait or Europe, wherever they may be, we don't really care where they are, but we have to know about them so our employers can plan for them. And I think that's key. And, it kind of comes down to the tricky thing now is employers understood and fully supported going to war to combat in Afghanistan or in Iraq or in Syria. What they don't understand less are these international strategic engagements that build alliances and partnerships that might be in Thailand. And people are deployed to Thailand and they're on Facebook with a picture of them on Pattaya Beach. And the employer's like, you're gone and you're doing this. And what's the good? We have to make them understand that it's a communication leadership problem to make them understand the strategic engagement value of our presence in these places. It builds partnerships, it builds presence, it builds our ability to engage when we need it. So it's a new leadership challenge for the men and women in these towns to convey why we are doing it. And I think in large measure, once you explain to them the need to engage and have allies and partners, they understand and they get on.
We've got one question on the sensitive matter of the June 3rd Washington, D.C. protest and response from Nicholas Schifrin of the PBS NewsHour. And he's asking about the status of the investigation and whether there are any preliminary lessons learned. So I know it's a tough topic, but just wondered if you had any thoughts to share today, General.
Is that the RC-26 investigation that's ongoing? Is that the one that he wants to know about? Or the helicopter investigation? There was two investigations.
He doesn't mention that specifically, so I'm not sure.
I think all of those investigations are still ongoing, and we definitely want to get to the bottom of all of them. And when we do, we'll make sure that, the dynamics of the civil unrest issue that started in Minneapolis and spread to Georgia and then around the nation to 33 other states, broadly speaking, so many bad things could have happened during that entire engagement that I'm very proud of the men and women of the Guard that did it. I mean, I think I can say this. I can think in D.C., as we did here in the District of Columbia, I don't think a National Guard member touched a protester. I mean, I don't think or there were cases when we were on the Lincoln Memorial and the rest and the like. But, you know, in general, I think that we provided a presence that supported law enforcement that was there to make sure people could peacefully protest and people wouldn't commit crimes. If they were, we could assist law enforcement to intervene. But those ongoing investigations are still happening. And when they're done, we'll make sure everybody knows what they say.
Combine a couple of questions into what will be the last one. We're running up on 3 o'clock pretty quickly, but there are two pandemic related questions. And one of them is sort of asking what you've learned in the last 6 months that you might have decided you want to, you know, learn lessons from either the response to COVID or the way COVID has affected the country that's led you to need to change something specifically about the National Guard, whether it's how you train people or whether it's, as you say, how you monitor so you don't pull the whole police department out of Northern Vermont when you go deploy a unit. So picking up on that, are there any particularly concrete insights that you've gained? And the other one is a little more speculative and talks about a potentially different kind of pandemic, a new pandemic that could be even worse, and whether you've sort of tried to already learn lessons from this response that could help you if the next one is even further out of control and maybe even more dangerous than COVID-19 has been. So those two over to you, General.
So I think, you know, we do after action reviews every time we're engaged in anything. You know, and I think we've got some lessons learned on how we train. You know, I can tell you that nobody, I think, ever anticipated that we would have to do simultaneous civil unrest activities in 33 states in the same 3-5 day period like we did most recently, you know, in D.C. and around the country. So I think we will put some more effort on our training and other ways to de-escalate situations should we get some soldier or some airman in a situation again where they feel more ready as you can be for that situation. And I've said many times in our domestic portfolio, what we do here in the homeland, civil unrest is our most difficult mission. We don't like doing it. It's hard to do. Frequently, there are members of one family on one side of the line and other members dressed in civil and riot gear on the other side. And it is a difficult situation for our men and women to be in. So we'll train better. We'll be ready. And we will do what we can to make sure that we're as prepared as we can possibly be. In my opinion, uniforms, I don't care what flavor they are, Title 10, active duty, National Guard, Reserve, uniforms being out there in law enforcement situations is not optimum. We should do as little of it as we can, and it should be predominantly a law enforcement police operation. And when they need us, we can and we will come, but we should do what we can to avoid that. We've looked at what the pandemic means for us across our deployment portfolio here. How do we do hurricanes? We've had conferences already on, you know, what does this pandemic hot zone thing mean for us as we go to evacuate nursing homes where we have high risk people? And how do we do things such that create shelters where social distancing is not possible? But this pandemic, it could happen again. There's no question, you know, and I think, you know, as important to the nation as having a hypersonic weapon or a new satellite is our nation needs to be able to develop and use vaccines and create these things at more faster speeds so that we can find them, test them and deploy them in a faster sense. So, you know, to the degree that we can help our nation do that, have other investments by being a less expensive force that contributes to the national defense of the country, I think that's a good thing. And, you know, I've been very, very proud. What have I learned? You know, I had thought my last 6 months would be go visit a few state partnership programs, go to Cairo and sign a new state partnership between Texas and Egypt, which I'm very proud of. I think it's going to be a great partnership. But all of that was put on hold because our nation was paralyzed. And, you know, basically we were put in a headlock as the world is to deal with the impacts of COVID. And we're not done yet. And we won't be done until there's a vaccine out there that changes things. So very proud of the Guard and their contribution to what they have done, not just in the COVID place, but also civil unrest and what we're doing. Title 10 is part of the Department of Defense and every combatant command around the world. So it's really all I got, Michael. Thanks for having me.
General, there's no better way to end than what you just said. So let me just join you in thanking the guardsmen and women across the force and around the world and across the country who have done so much to help us through this crisis and continue to do so. And thank you for your service, your friendship, your collegiality with us at Brookings, but also what you've done for the country, and very best wishes going forward. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Honored to do it. Thanks for having me.